So much is artificial. Our laws, the way we govern ourselves are artificial. So that's good. That means it was designed, not by professional designers, but by people trying to change and make and modify the way we live. That means maybe we can change it. And that's the whole thrust of the book. You have to understand the history. Because the way we were brought up, the way we were born, the people we lived in at first, makes everything we do seem natural. And I want you to step back and say, all those things that seem natural and obvious are not natural and obvious. They're artificial. And if you go to some other country and you observe what they do, they may do things completely different. So that gave me hope, though, that maybe it's designers got us into this. Well, maybe designers can get us out of today's problem. Because the hardest problem is not the technology, not the economics, not the behavior. The hardest problem is human behavior.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Design Drawers, where we explore why, how, and what design and designers are driving forward. The mission is to interview the most forward-thinking designers and most innovative creators on the planet to inspire and help you to reach your full creator potential and also make a positive impact in the world. In this episode, I had the chance to chat with the one and only Don Norman on his new book called Design for a Better World. During the episode, we dive into the fact that everything is actually designed, that we experience as human beings. And while we are part of the problem when it comes to the environment and the planet and the challenges we're having as humanity, we're also part of the solution. So in the episode, we discuss the importance of meaning, the importance of sustainability, and the importance of what he calls humanity-centered design. So hope you enjoy the episode. All right, I'm here with Don Norman. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You're quite welcome. And it's good to see you, Sebastian.
Yeah, good to see you. We already had a really good initial discussion on the context of this episode. You recently wrote a new book, Design for a Better World, which I already had the chance to read. And in this book, you're focusing on three aspects: creating meaning, or designing for meaning, sustainability, and designing for humanity. So I'm really looking forward to dive into these three aspects with you. But before we kind of diving straight into it, Don, I think it would be really interesting maybe for the audience to understand also your personal history maybe a little bit better. When did it all started out for you, thinking about design, thinking about becoming a designer, even consciously, basically going into the field designing?
Well, almost everything I've done has been an accident. And so I've learned actually to look for accidents, look for unexpected opportunities. And especially if it's something very different from what I've been doing or used to, I take it. So I started off as an electrical engineer. I got a degree from MIT in electrical engineering. Went to the University of Pennsylvania in the United States to get a master's degree in electrical engineering, and I wanted to work on computers, but this was a really long time ago. And so the very first computer had been built in the United States at the University of Pennsylvania, but nobody was there anymore. So in fact, there was nobody to teach computers, and they said, well, stick around and maybe we'll start a computer science department. You could be the very first member. But just then psychology happened, and the new chair of psychology was a physicist. And I heard him give a talk, and I said, oh, yeah, I want to build intelligent machines. And well, maybe I should just instead study this, which is the existing intelligent machine. And so I switched to psychology and got a PhD in psychology and got my first job at Harvard. And it sort of life went on from there. I left Harvard and came to the University of California, San Diego, and it was just starting. No student had yet graduated. So it was a brand new psychology department. There were only three people there who hired six people. I was one of those six. And I was in a field which I called information processing psychology, which used my engineering background to try to understand psychology. Which was not liked by both psychologists. When I joined Harvard and my mentor, George Miller, who understood what I did and liked it, he introduced me to the faculty and B.F. Skinner, the most famous psychologist of the 20th century, B.F. Skinner stood up and denounced me in my field, saying it was nonsense. You could not study things that you could not observe. He only wanted to study observable behavior. He would have been a bad chemist or a bad physicist. But I found that amusing, by the way. But at San Diego, I found a great home because information processing psychology, it fit in with everything that we were trying to accomplish. And that eventually became cognitive psychology. I became chair of that department, but it was still constraining. Psychologists had their own special methods. And I wanted to look outside. I wanted to bring in linguistics. I wanted to bring in computer science, especially artificial intelligence, which was just beginning that field. And I wanted to bring in sociology and anthropology and communication and other fields. And so what happened was cognitive science was just an emerging field. So I actually started the very first department of cognitive science at UC San Diego, which was easier to do than at any other university because it was a young university growing. So there were lots of hirings and lots of opportunities, and people welcomed that. So I became a cognitive scientist. And at one point I got called in to help with the Three Mile Island nuclear power accident, the first big accident in nuclear power. And I was asked to understand why did the people make such, why were the operators so stupid? They made errors. Well, the group of people I was in the committee looking at this, we all looked at that and said, no, they were very intelligent. They did the best job they did. But the plant, it was designed as if it was designed to cause errors. You couldn't have made a better plant that would cause errors. And that made me say, oh, I have an engineering background. I understand people. And I started studying human error. And I started to do research with NASA on aviation safety. And that's where I really started to discover design. And so I wrote the book, The Design of Everyday Things. And then I retired from the university and went up to Apple and became eventually a vice president of Apple. Before that, I started the User Experience Architect's Office at Apple. First use of the term user experience. And then I became a vice president. And that's where I learned what real design was about. I'd already written The Design of Everyday Things, but I didn't really know what the field of design was about. And I learned from the designers there at Apple and from the usability teams and so on. And in fact, the reason I went to Apple was that they had a really good a manual for developers on their whole principles. And
Human Design Guidelines, yeah.
Human Design Guidelines. And it was actually written by my students who had jobs at Apple. And so it was really, when I went there, I felt like I was coming home. It was a really nice place to work and to learn about industry, and that industry is very different than academics. They are very different fields, but they both need each other. And what I learned from industry was that all the stuff I'd studied in academics, well, yeah, fine, but it really didn't matter when you made things. And when I wanted to make things, we had all sorts of questions that the academics never thought of studying. So I thought, oh, it's interesting, because what academics study is useful for industry, but it's usually very academic and not applied. So you have to modify it to apply it. And then industry has lots of questions that academics are the correct people to answer, but they didn't know those questions because they lived in a different world. And so I thought going back and forth has been very powerful in my development. And I did a whole bunch of stuff after that. I won't bother to list them all, but I did start the Nielsen-Norman group with Jacob Nielsen. That's still going on strong. And I moved to Northwestern University, where I was in the computer science department, but I started a design group. And I've come now to know designers. And you're in Munich, and I spent 3 years working with BMW in Munich. So I would fly to Munich once every 2 months or so and spend time with the team there, professors from both TUM and the, I guess it's called the University of Munich in English. Mm-hmm. And I can never remember the German name. Yeah. So that's sort of my background.
Right. I think it was really interesting. What you're pointing out is sort of the connection between the science and then the art, sort of say, or the science and then sort of the technical implementation, right? And it kind of needs both sides, right? It needs this perspective from the scientific, from the psychology side that you mentioned, but then also there are other questions arising as you actually starting to implement things. And you need to put it in form, you need to put it in artifacts and need to shape that experience. And sort of that's where I think the balance also comes with.
But you need to go beyond that. The problem with designers is, first of all, most of them come out of art schools. Not if you went to TUM, Technical University of Munich, that's not an art school. So you get a good, you were surrounded by engineers and technical people, which is good, in my opinion. And but most designers come out of art. It's a lot of design schools are either in the art department or art and architecture, or even standalone art schools are often schools, the Savannah College of Art and Design. But design is not art. And these, because artists are trying to express themselves, and they often want to show an approach or giving their opinions or make a commentary upon the world. And I like art. I buy a lot of art. I use art, but it's not art. It's not design. Design is you're designing for other people. And that's a very, very different thing. And designers who think they just think about a problem and they come up with a solution or they do it, no, they're being artists. And quite often their work may be beautiful, it may be nice, I may even buy it, but it's not very practical. You know, Philip Stark, he has the famous juice squeezer. Juicy Salif, he calls it. Mm-hmm. Well, I have that in my living room. I call it art. I don't have it in my kitchen where I might use it to squeeze, but he did that on purpose, and I approve of that. A good designer, but he said, look, this piece is not about making juice. This piece is about making conversation, which is what good art does. So, but here's the problem. And this is a good way of getting leading into my new book.
Right.
In 1971, Victor Papadak, a well-known designer at that time, mm-hmm. wrote a book called The Design for the Real World. And the very first sentence of the book was, there is no field more dangerous, more harmful than design. And why did he say that? Well, he went on to say, because designers design all the crap that people buy that pollutes the world. Pollutes, he didn't say this, I'll expand, but I know he was thinking this. Pollutes the world because of when we mine the world to get the materials to make the device, and then when we manufacture it and spit out all the pollution, and then when we discard it into big heaps of trash. So why are we doing that? And then he said, well, maybe actually design isn't the worst field. The worst field might be advertising, which convinces people to buy all that crap. Well, he was wrong. He was right in his ideas, he's right in the spirit, but he was wrong to blame designers. And the reason you shouldn't blame designers is because designers have no power. Designers are in the middle level, even in the university, the design department is never the most important department in the university. That's starting to change, by the way. The place that's changing most rapidly is India, where they're starting to elevate design very highly. And a little bit in the United States, MIT has done that, Stanford has done that. Northwestern makes design very important in the School of Engineering, but it's still rare. And in business, design is almost always in the middle. Very seldom is there a chief design officer at the top level of executives, what we call the C-suite, a chief executive officer, the chief financial officer, chief marketing, and chief design. It is rare to find a big company that has a chief design officer. In Europe, Philips is one of them. So there is a chief design officer at Philips, it makes a difference in their products. So why is that? Because designers don't know anything except design. They don't know about the world. They don't know about the world of business. They don't know the other fields. They don't understand human factors, which is so critically important, or psychology, or anthropology, or history. or the humanities. Because if you want to know who understands people best, it's not the psychologists, not the sociologists. It's the people who write novels. Because in order to write a novel, to do great literature, you have to be an incredible observer of people. Mm-hmm. Because you have to understand and write about people and their lives and the things that they experience and how they respond and how different people in the novel respond differently. Well, that's what makes for good design. I'm trying very hard to change how we educate designers to give them a broader background so that also to understand business and the world and the history that got us to this place so that they can rise up to positions of leadership. Because if you want to move up in a company, you have to think not first of design, you have to think most about the company. What makes the company successful? How should you change it? Nowadays, I'm saying we better think about the world because we design something that destroys the world. Why do we do that? You take a look at modern computers and cell phones. We try to make them so slim and so lightweight and so beautiful to look at. But we use exotic materials, we mine them, and then we meld them, and we meld them together with other stuff, and we glue everything together. It's very difficult to take apart, very difficult to separate. Although you could actually reuse most of the materials, you can't reuse them if you can't separate them. In fact, to go to a different example, in the United States, most milk comes in what looks like cardboard cartons. Well, gee, cardboard, you can recycle that, right? No, because you can't pour milk into cardboard. So you have a very thin piece of film of plastic on the inside of the box that keeps the milk pure. But it also means it's almost impossible to recycle because you need special machines to get rid of that plastic, and very few places have it. So we have to become attuned to the environment. We have to think about the world, not just the person who might use our product. Because the world is using the product when you throw it away, when you mine, and when you manufacture. And we have to be able to be in a position of power where we can change the way that this is manufactured, change the materials we're using, move towards what's called a circular economy, so everything gets reused. And you can't do that if you just think about, oh, I'm making a beautiful design, and isn't it pretty and lovely? And on top of that, designers just make the picture, the drawings. They're not involved in the actual manufacturing. And so they often complain, oh, the marketing department or the engineering department or the manufacturing department destroyed my perfect design. Why did they do that? Well, it wasn't perfect if they felt they had to change it, was it? And why weren't they involved in your design process? When you designed, why didn't you have someone from manufacturing and from engineering in your team and from marketing? And why did you let it go? Why didn't you take part in how it got manufactured and how it got distributed and how it got used? But we have to change a lot. And my book is about that. My book is really about the gaps we have in the way we live in this world. That was a long answer to your question.
No, I didn't want to stop you because you said so many interesting aspects, and there are, you know, a lot of, I think, paths we could take this now. And I think you touched on some very important aspects. I think what is really interesting is, like you said, like, well, design is one of the key problems. Designers are sort of right at the center where there are a lot of decisions that get made, you know, for example, for the environment.
Are at the center. That's the problem. They are told what to do.
Yeah.
And if they, and I just got a wonderful email from a woman who actually lives in Berlin, who tried to convince her company she was doing things wrong. And the result was, well, first of all, every person she talked to passed her on to some other person. And eventually what they did was they fired her. Oh. Yeah. And so you have to actually be up in a position of some authority. And it's true, if we change things, it's going to really be disruptive to the company. So we have to be sensitive to that. And one of the things that we tell my friends and I would tell young students is, when you get a job and you find that there are problems, do not go to your boss and your executives and tell them there are problems. Executives don't want to hear people coming up and saying there are problems. And it's not because they don't want to know about it. Yeah, they should know about it. But what they want you to do is tell them the solutions. And the solutions have to be one that fits within the company and doesn't make the company go bankrupt. Or doesn't make the company lose business because, oh, you have a wonderful solution, but it costs so much money to do that we had to raise our prices and then people didn't buy our products. No, you have to figure out how to manage it. That's
right.
And these leaders say, well, that's politics and that's business. That's not design. And I say, you want design to be successful? That's essential. Now, every designer doesn't have to be that way. But every design group has to have a leader who is that way.
Right. Yeah, let's talk about this maybe for a second before we diving deeper also in other parts of your book. I think you touched on something really important. And I think a lot of like designers are always asking themselves that, like how they can have more impact in a company and actually driving forward that change. And I think very often it's like you said, it's connected to do what also helps the business. But it, I think in the beginning, it all starts with empathy, right? Like understanding, first of all, as a designer, you already have a lot of empathy for the user, right? But then it's also about having an understanding about the business and how the business operates. What are the decisions that
it
gets made?
I always say designers are taught to understand your customer, right? So we go off, we study the customer, we speak the language of the customer. But who is your customer, designers? I always ask them, oh, well, you know, it's a person who buys my product and uses it. Yes, that's one of them.
Yeah.
Your customer is your boss, or to be more accurate, the boss of your boss, or maybe the boss of the boss of your boss. So you must speak their language. So how do you talk to them? Oh, we show them our wonderful designs, and we show them the prizes we've won in contests, and people write us letters about how nice it is. Yeah, well, if I was an executive and you came and told me that, I would say, yes, thank you very much for letting me know. That's why we hired you, of course, because we know you're good. So thank you very much. But now, excuse me, but I must get back to work. That's not how you convince somebody to take you seriously, because you're telling them I'm doing a good job and why, you know, and what you hired me for. By the way, those prizes are sort of ridiculous because you get prizes for things based on superficial characteristics. I've been on the jury of a lot of these prizes, and I know that you can't evaluate them properly, because in order to evaluate a design properly, you have to use it for a while. And we can't afford to do that when there's hundreds of, you know, of candidates for prizes. We can't spend weeks with each one. So the prizes don't tell you very much. So don't be proud of your prizes. Be proud of them, but don't think that they are realistic.
No, yeah, 100%.
So if you want to understand your manager, you've got to speak the manager's language, which is profits and losses and return on investment, and use a spreadsheet. Well, I don't know how to use a spreadsheet. Show him how to increase sales and increase profits or decrease costs. Well, how would I do that? How do I know that? Well, marketing does it all the time. Why don't you become friends with marketing? Have them do that for you. And you know how they do it? They lie. They make up numbers. Because nobody knows what those answers are, so you have to make up numbers. Now, the executives, when they see them, they know they're lying. They know they're made up numbers, because that's what they themselves used to do. The question they ask is, are they sensible? What are the assumptions you made? How did you put together these numbers? And if it's sensible, they'll take it seriously.
Yeah, it's all based on assumptions. You're trying to predict things based on assumptions, right? And I think I had Kevin Bethune on the podcast. He said, designers need to, if you are trying to win over other people for an idea in a company, it's like learning the language of businesses, right? It's like learning a language, like learning, you know, French or German, right? And you don't need to know all words, but you need to know a good amount of words, enough for people to convince you about your design. And you frame your design differently. You talk about complete different things than you may talk internally with your design stakeholders. You need to communicate that differently. And I think Yeah, I think you also said something interesting is that, you know, like in, it doesn't need to be everyone in the design team, but you need one that does it in the team to advocate for these ideas, right? Because otherwise you don't drive forward any change, right? You can also look at this sort of in a simple sort of win-win framework, right? So you have the desirability, the feasibility, and the viability, right? And if to win it, to win over other people for an idea, you need to have a win-win, right? Either win-win with the business side or the technical side. I think it's it's very often also easier to find all of the win-win with the business side if you find like a good argumentation for something.
Yes, because designers and engineers don't always get along, right?
Oftentimes great design requires great engineering, right? So meaning like a great design solution but most often requires an extra mile for an engineer very often, right? But it requires that, you know, there is no, if I mean, you worked at Apple, I had other past Apple employees also on the podcast. I mean, like one of the things also with Apple, for example, Apple has amazing design, of course, with the work they are doing. But, you know, very often, if you look at the design solution, they also require great engineering. So often it's great engineering behind that that makes it a great design in the first place. And of course, people say like, well, it's a great
design. When it's a physical product,
right?
Then you have to worry about the manufacturing side too. So right. It may require great manufacturing skills because some of them require new machines in the manufacturing side, which cost millions and millions of euros.
Right.
And so it's not simple. But if the team works together, that's why I want the manufacturing and the salespeople and the marketing people and the engineering people and the designers to all be on the same team working together for the product. That's where you get wonderful results.
You need shared ownership. If you're just carrying forward the idea without letting other people carrying that forward also, I think then it's also not a great chance of success. And then, like you said, it's like working with the other stakeholders and there's going to be friction. Like you said, like if you have these discussions, they're always going to be friction. But like in the friction, there is the innovation, right? I mean, like,
yes.
Otherwise you're not creating something new, right?
If you do the friction as we have different points of view and they coincide, they collapse, they don't agree with each other. But if you stay friendly with the people, friction then turns out to be good. And often great insights come from that friction as we're trying to resolve it. And we think of a whole new way of doing something that could be brilliant. But if you use the friction just to become enemies, then, in fact, it's a disaster.
Right, right.
I blame universities because universities have fields. And in the fields, you have majors. In the majors, you have specializations. And so, and moreover, you get graded by the university in unmeaningful ways. Grades don't mean anything. They mean how well you can pass a test or satisfy the professor. They don't really tell how well you can apply the knowledge that you have. And second, you're supposed to work by yourself. Well, how could we give grades to somebody if we didn't know what they could do all by themselves? If they work with the team, we don't know what part they contributed. But the world works in teams. We don't do designs anymore by ourselves. Well, you have to have a whole team of people. Yeah. We don't. The university doesn't train you to work with teams. And even some design departments, yes, we do. We have project, or we have to have the graphic designers with the interaction designers with the industrial designers. Yeah, but they're still all designers.
Yeah,
they still have the same frictions. They have to learn to work together. But why don't you have some mechanical engineers or some chemists or somebody from the business school as part of the team?
Yeah.
No, we don't teach that way. And we don't reward professors that way. We reward professors for being the very best in their very narrow field. So professors themselves don't often work in multidisciplinary.
But
that's how
the reality works, yeah. You mentioned friction. Friction is already, I think, a great sort of vehicle over to, improving the world because there's a lot of friction out there. And in your book, Design for a Better World, of course, like you touch on these different aspects and how we can overcome some of that friction. What was your main motivation writing the book in the first place? What was like the driving force for you?
Oh, it was came about for lots of reasons. I'm getting older, so I've studied what do I want to be known for at the end? And I wanted a book that sort of took all of my pretty wide-ranging experiences and used it to try to do bigger things in my other books. Because most of my design books are all about how to make things that are easier to use, easier to understand, more effective, et cetera. Well, that's good, and that's important, and I'm happy with the results of the books, but that isn't really changing the world. Well, as I was thinking about all of this, the world itself was changing. And so we had all the eruptions about Black Lives Matter, about sexual prejudices and gender biases. And we had a pandemic. We had COVID that came. And so the whole world was changing in many, many different ways. And it made me step back and try to think about what really was going on. When COVID happened, how come we weren't prepared? Because infectious disease doctors have been predicting this for years and years and years, and there even were plans in place to know how to approach the next big pandemic. But when it happened, oh, what do we do? And people even ignored all the good plans that had been made. And second, we do have lots and lots of prejudices and biases in the world. And it's time to eradicate that. And a lot of people were trying to say the Western powers, which mainly was from Europe and the United States, colonized the world and made the other countries behave differently, changed them. And that wasn't good. So having a homogeneous world is dull and, in fact, bad for the people who were forced to live in the Western style, which was very different from their culture. And the world is a richer place if we actually bring back all these different cultures. And the most important thing is we could tolerate all sorts of things only, though, if the groups that we are tolerating themselves are open to other ideas. And the world's problems are when someone says, I know the truth. And so if you don't understand my truth, then you are wrong and evil, and I will get rid of you. That's the danger in the world. But I wanted to address these issues. I wanted to talk about how much of the world is artificial. The notion of a country is artificial. The notion of a week is artificial. Now, the notion of a month is kind of natural because it comes about from the way that the moon goes around the earth and the earth goes around the sun. So the notion of a year and a month and a day are kind of natural, but not that the day should have 24 hours. That's not natural. That was invented. The week was invented. The seasons were invented. Yeah, of course, it's different when in the summer when the sun is, when we're at a different angle to the sun and different in the winter. But okay, there's two seasons. But if you live on the equator, you don't have seasons. And if you actually look around the world, some places have six seasons of the year. Some places have only two seasons, raining and not raining. And So much is artificial. Our laws, the way we govern ourselves are artificial. So that's good. That means it was designed, not by professional designers, but by people trying to change and modify the way we live. That means maybe we can change it. And that's the whole thrust of the book, that you have to understand the history. Because the way we were brought up, the way we were born, the people we lived in at first, makes everything we do seem natural. And I want you to step back and say, all those things that seem natural and obvious are not natural and obvious. They are artificial. And if you go to some other country and you observe what they do, they may do things completely differently. So that gave me hope, though, that maybe it's designers got us into this. Well, maybe designers can get us out of today's problems. Because the hardest problem is not the technology, not the economics, not the behavior. The hardest problem is human behavior.
I really love that, like how you starting the book basically with a picture that basically points out of your window, right?
Where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah.
I took a picture right there. I'm looking due south and I can see, I see a wonderful I see trees, I see grass, I see animals, lots of different kinds of birds. They're all artificial. The palm trees are artificial. I mean, they're real palm trees, but this used to be a steep hill. So it had to be smoothed and made level. And everything was planted. The palm trees were planted by people, which made it a habitat for those animals to be able to live here. And even the city in the background, and all the way, I could see all the way into Mexico from where I'm sitting right now. And it's mostly artificial.
Right.
That Mexico is real, yes, but why is the boundary between Mexico and the United States at that location? That was a big fight and it was artificial.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting. I mean, that, you know, you took that example and just pointed out about like everything that is artificial, even if it's nature, of course. But I think what is maybe interesting here is, I mean, obviously, if you look around, in the world, a lot of these things are artificial. Let's say you're in a city, like there are all of these buildings. Everything was somehow touched, artificially shaped. But they don't really did it together, right? A lot of things are really random if you think about it, right? It's random, it's artificial, and it's very random. It's not consciously and intentionally designed. And that's maybe that's the difference,
Well, often it is consciously and intentionally designed. That's part of the definition of design, that it was conscious and intentional. Yeah. Without thinking about the implications upon everything else. You know, lots of people love to send me pictures of really bad design. And I say, well, it's easy to find examples of bad design. I want you to tell me how it happened. How come intelligent people produce something you think is so bad and difficult to use? And almost always, it's because there are different groups of people who had to produce that and they didn't talk to each other. Light switches in a room are often in the wrong place, and they often control the wrong things, and there are too many light switches. You don't know what each one does. And I say, whose fault was that? Probably the architect designed the building, and then an interior designer designed the room, where the rooms would be and what they would be. And then someone else decided that you needed lights, and then someone called in the electrician, and the electrician had to install the lights. But they didn't know how the room was to be used. So they did the best they could. And now you complain that the switches don't, match the way we use the room. Well, whose fault is that? It isn't any person's fault. It's a lack of communication among the disciplines. And so that's when you say that designs are all random. They may be good designs by themselves.
Right.
But they're not together by themselves. They're mixed up with all the rest.
There is a time aspect that you touch about that you talk about, right? Like the plugs, for example, in the building. It was one part of there was one iteration, right? And then there was another iteration where someone tried to design then the room with the furniture. The same you could, and like with the example in the city, where it's like building on top of each other, right? In time, basically. Yeah. It's designed in time, but it's like it's captured processes, right? You don't know what the next process is going to be, or you maybe not have access to the information in order to design it for what is next.
Not only that, but you may be designing today, and it may even work. You may have looked at all these possible interactions, but 10 years from now, the world is different. Things have changed a lot. So what seemed to be perfect now maybe restricts and confines you and gets in the way for what you need 10 years from now.
Right. Yeah, I think this is so interesting also that you say, like, basically, I think when we're talking about that things are artificially sort of designed, like seasons and time, etc., right? It's a level of abstraction, right? We're trying to make sense out of the world. We're trying to simplify things so people can deal with the complexity, right? Yeah, I think it's a fascinating
thing. That's the wrong way to do it. I say, I wrote a book about that, Living with Complexity, which I said, simplicity is in the head, not in the world. If you understand something, it's simple. So, and I like to use my kitchen as an example. Our kitchen is perfectly set up for me and for my wife. We know where everything is. We can work together. We designed it so that two of us can work at the same time. And everything is where it ought to be for the way we work. If somebody else comes into my kitchen and tries to make something, it's a disaster. They can't find anything. Or if I go to somebody else's house and try to use their kitchen, it's a disaster. Because we designed our own house and where we put all our stuff. And so to us, it's simple. It's somebody else who has no idea why we're doing what we're doing. They think it's so complicated. How can you live here? So simplicity is in the head. And if you design things that are understandable, they could actually be very quite complex, but to the person using it, no, it's simple.
Yeah, and I think that that is sort of that user centeredness, that the human center aspect that you're describing, right? It's connected to behavior, like I said, with your kitchen, right? What are you used to? And I think I love your quote: "If design got us into today's mess, can design get us out?" Right? So, yeah. So basically, but you also said, if design is to save the world, it must be a different kind of design.
The designers, first of all, have to learn more about the world. They have to be more broadly educated and more sensitive to the impact their designs have on the ecosystem of the world or the cultures of the world. And second, I want designers to be more important, because what we do is very important to human behavior for living in the world. And so, but to be more important, you have to take a broader point of view and move up in the hierarchy in political situations, in your company, and in the universities. You know, we like to measure people's intelligence with a number. We like to measure the gross domestic product of a country, a single number to summarize the economic status of the company.
Right.
Both of these are wrong. It's an oversimplification. And yet in the gross domestic product, we measure how much a company spends. It could be for evil or it could be for good. Both of them count equally in the measure. Whereas there are dozens, hundreds of factors, thousands that go into this. Why don't we specify what the critical ones are? We can say, not that this country is the leader in highest gross domestic product, but this country is the best in healthcare, but it's not so good in education, or it's not so good in this, and not so good in that. And this other country is a better, we can list the attributes, much more meaningful. Intelligence, as far as I'm concerned, an intelligence test tells you how well you perform on intelligence tests. And it also tells you perhaps a little bit how well you might perform in the university or in school in taking tests. But as we all know, the people who graduate at the top of their class often are not the people who are most successful. They're really good at taking tests, but are they good at doing good things in the world? Not necessarily. So why don't we measure the different attributes and spell them out separately? So we all understand where we are strong and where we are weak. But no, we try to oversimplify by using a single number. That's wrong.
Yeah, I think the another quote you made was about or another aspect was around like human behavior being at the core of this, right? So basically you say like, well, design got us in today's mess. How can design get us out? One of the contexts is human behavior. Human behavior brought us our world to the brink. Human behavior can save us, right? So how do we design for human behavior in the way that, you know, it can save us?
See my pause when I start to figure out how am I going to answer, because that is one of the best questions that we have to ask ourselves. And we don't have any really good answers.
Yeah.
The hardest problems to solve are the ones for which we do not know answers.
Yeah.
But there has been some good work. You know, there's a lot of good psychologists who are working to develop really good applied psychology. And actually, there are in the field of economics, which really had almost no real understanding of people, where they used to talk about people as if people were logical decision makers, which they aren't, because logic is an artificial. Logic is not how people think. Logic was invented by mathematicians and philosophers. So, but fortunately, there was a bunch of people that started with Herb Simon, who it's not even clear what field he was in. It was in organizational behavior. He helped start the field of artificial intelligence. He was in psychology, he was in economics, he was in all these different fields, and he got the Nobel Prize in economics. And the economists didn't like that. They said, well, he's not an economist. Well, but he was trying to say that you have to understand rationality. You have to understand how people behave. And they don't behave the way you think, because you're assuming that they can take into account all the information that is necessary and make a sensible decision. No, the mind can't handle all that information. We have to select what we use. And so what we do is we don't optimize, we satisfice. We find something that seems satisfactory and we go with that. And he got the Nobel Prize, but wasn't well respected. But then later on, Tversky and Kahneman got the Nobel Prize. Well, only Kahneman. Tversky made a mistake. He died. You can't get the Nobel Prize if you die. But they were psychologists. And what they argued was, again, that, you know, human behavior is very complex. And let's take a look at real human behavior. But let's also suggest how we might use that behavior to change things. And so actually, the most important paper ever written by them was not a scientific paper. It was a popular book called Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow by Danny Kahneman, because that actually made it understandable for people who are starting to use that word. And then last economist was wrote the book called Nudge, Richard Thaler, who got a Nobel Prize in economics. And he actually was an economist. But he actually came to my office when I was at Northwestern in Chicago and said, I just wrote this book and I think it's a design book. So maybe you could write a little blurb for me about why it's a good design book. And I did. And it was designed because he talked about how you can change people's behavior. You can have people eat more healthy if you simply make it harder for them to find the unhealthy food. You can get people to save better when they are asked when they get a job and they ask if they want to, put some of their money in a retirement fund. Well, don't ask them if they want to put it in. Tell them, we automatically put the money in the retirement fund. But if you want, you can ask us not to do that. That's called opt-in versus opt-out. And he demonstrated that simple little thing, whether you opt-in or opt-out, makes all the difference in the world whether you're actually doing what is good for you. And so there's lots of people who are doing the small things that are making a difference. And there's even more that we could do. And I try to address it in the book. But one of the problems we face is that scientists describe things in such meaningless terms for people, they don't understand. Climate change is really hard to understand because every little action we do builds things into the climate. And yet we do just a simple thing. I just throw away something. That can't change anything. The world is so big. What does it matter what I do? Well, there are 8 billion of us. And second is that the world has these feedback loops and feedforward loops. Now, people don't understand those loops. Most people barely understand a thermostat in the home or even in your stove when you set the oven for a given temperature. They think that, for example, if I want to get the oven up faster, I'll turn the heat up more. And then I'll correct it. Or I want it up cold when I come into my house, so I turn the heat up all the way to the maximum so it'll heat up faster. No, it doesn't work that way. And worse, because you forget to turn it down, you overshoot. So people look for simple causality. Lots of causality is not simple. They look for simple linearity, and things are not linear. They're feedback and feed forward with multiple loops, some of which are nonlinear, and some of which can take a decade, 10 years to have an impact upon the world. These are hard to understand. So we need good, better communicators who can make it easier for people to understand these complex things. And people are also, when there's a tragedy, people are often really good at stepping in to try to overcome the problems caused by that tragedy. But they don't spend any time trying to avoid the tragedy in the first place. Right. Because it's invisible. You have to make a prediction. And that's a nonsensical prediction, they feel, because there's nothing to see. And so you basically attack things that you see, which means you attack the symptoms and not the causes.
That's the same issue in healthcare, right? I mean, I think
it is the issue in healthcare. Yeah, absolutely.
We we're only focusing on solving the problems when they are there, but like the journey started way earlier. So I think like being preventive about things, and I think you're touching on climate change, which, you know, it's the same issue, I think, you can find parallels to healthcare there, that the problem is also that before the problem arises, it's very intangible, right? It's like you cannot see it. With climate change, you cannot see it in front of your eyes. But your bank account, you can check, like, you know, finance decisions, they're very direct. You're going to notice these things more tangibly, yeah? With, you know, healthcare, maybe at some point you're going to feel something and then you start to kind of wake up to like the problem. But with climate change, often like these things are very intangible. Also, they're actually the consequences are in different countries. So you don't even notice it. All you see is maybe images on the internet, but people are not so sensible, I think, to that, or it doesn't change people because necessarily.
You see the images of problems someplace else.
Right.
So what I like to say is the bad news about climate change is that it's here. It's already causing fires, floods, famine, huge winds, huge destruction. That's the bad news. Right. But the good news is that climate change is already here. It's already causing floods and famine and destruction and et cetera. And the reason that's good is because it's hitting all people all over the world. And so for the first time, people are taking climate change seriously and starting to worry and do things about it.
What do you say about like going back maybe a little bit to the human behavior aspect? I think this is also really interesting. I mean, it's of course like a complex topic, but I think like more and more designers kind of waking up to the idea that they're influencing this. I think there are more and more frameworks that sort of try to measure this in a certain way or make it easy for people to measure it via data that you may be getting out of the product, or maybe that you can survey out of your the results of what you're doing. So it becomes more and more, let's say, accessible in a design process, but still it's sometimes that not even time to think about it. Last week I gave a talk in Switzerland, and I talked about like this sort of like three layers of impact, so to say. One layer was the strategy side. Designers are not really present there. This is requirements, how the company is functioning, what are the processes, how the operation works, the actual decisions, the requirements you get then in the output phase, which is where design is usually designing the artifact that the company is producing. And then the last layer is the outcome phase, whatever artifact you're moving forward results into behavior and consequences and impact in the world. And I think more and more designers are waking up to, I think, both sides, right? I think the strategy side is basically, I think we touched on that in the beginning of the conversation, how to be involved there. And the other side is being the outcome phase, like how do you consciously shape that? And another thing I would like to add on that is that I feel like out of driven by business, I think there are more and more frameworks coming into place where people may be using behavior, first of all, maybe in a negative way in order to create more profit. But I think this has been already understood, I think, by the business world, that if you can shape behavior consciously, customer behavior or the behavior of an audience, you can create a profit. And there's for example a book on this, Hooked, for example. I think like you can take these principles also and use it for you as a designer to do good. Yeah, because so I feel like we're making overall, I think, the community, not even within design, but more broadly, or even in the world of business, making progress to find ways how to have processes where you more intentionally design behavior for good or for bad. Yeah. But I feel like there is a certain progress that is happening. And I think it's about like, how can we use that in our discipline of design to design for a better world?
What I'm very pleased about is the number of people now who are starting to talk about this, a large number of people and corporations, companies, large companies and countries starting to worry about this. And story you just told was wonderful. And that's a good example. So I'm not the only person saying this. You just did a really eloquent, excellent explanation of what these issues are. And one of the things we have to do, actually three of the things we have to do in order to overcome them. And so the very fact that you could give that story and others are giving that story, and a whole bunch of new books are coming out now about these very same issues from designers, but and from non-designers as well. So that gives me a lot of hope. So thank you for that. That was a wonderful as if I'm interviewing you. That was a really good way of presenting.
Glad you are finding their similarities, like that we're sharing that perspective, I think. And but it's still I think like one of the things with designers is also that is tools, so on processes, right? I feel like if you're looking at an aspect like accessibility, for example, right, I think, I mean, you have a lot more of course experience than me kind of looking at the overall history of design, but of course there was always the problem of accessibility. But I think if you're looking at how designers are working these days, it's way more systemized in the design process to consider this if you do an interface. And of course, it's not perfect, but you know, there are things like color contrast aspects and things that you can measure. There are even laws coming into place that put sort of frameworks around it to guide that process. It's now very easy, you could almost say snackable, for designers to include these things in the design process, right? I feel like with some of these newer aspects, so I think the accessibility of a new way of thinking to make this part of a design process plays a role in terms of how much an idea multiplies, or like how much designers are picking up on a new aspect. Like if we take in the aspect of accessibility, but you can take a diversity and inclusion, for example, as other similar problems. Not that they are solved, but I think like people trying to find ways like how to include these things in their design process and make this part of their standards. My hope is that if we are as a community moving forward with topics like sustainability, that we're finding ways how to, or behavior, we're finding ways how to integrate such a thing in a more easy way into a design process, almost like a quality criteria, right? How do you see that aspects of tools and frameworks and sort of like kind of as the, because there is knowledge, right? There is people talking about an aspect, right? And then it's about people know about something, but then there is the transfer to us like integrating into their work. How do you see that kind of progressing in terms of the topics that are important to you also in terms of sustainability?
I think that again, you've hit on a very important tendency and trend that's happening. Because, for example, in accessibility, which was fought for a long time by people, why are we doing that? It's just a small number of people who need it. Well, the reason it was a small number of people, they thought, was because all the people who needed the stuff were hidden. People who had trouble reading, well, they didn't read because they had trouble reading. We could make it so they could read, but they weren't visible to us. People who couldn't get around or handicapped in walking, well, they stayed at home, so we didn't see them. And so there was huge numbers of people that were impacted, but weren't visible. So when we started making things that were more accessible for more people, not only did these people suddenly start to emerge because now they could live a more normal life and get out in the world, but guess what? Things that we made for the people with handicaps of various sorts turned out to help everybody. And so you were doing good for everybody. And there's a wonderful book by Kat Holmes who talks about, it's called Misfits. And she says, you know, so somebody loses an arm, how do they get along with only one arm? Well, guess what? We all lose an arm now and then. I'm carrying a baby in my right hand. And so I can't open my car door because I can't get to my key and I can't do things, or I can't load packages in, or I have only one arm. So a lot of us, because of the way we work and the way we do things, are sometimes handicapped because we're doing something with the rest of our body. And so the same things that make it easier for everyday people, for the people we're targeting, it's easier for all of us as well. And people fought closed captions. The deaf community really wanted the closed captions so that they could read what was being said and they couldn't hear. Well, people fought it. But now it's become really popular. First of all, if someone has a bad accent, I put on closed captions so I can see what they're saying. Even on Zoom calls, I will click the closed caption so I can see what people are saying. And if you're in a bar where it's really noisy, you can't hear what's going on. And so the bars use closed captions all the time. You want to know what's going on the screen because it's usually a news program or a game. The closed captions are very valuable. And it's exactly a good example of all the points that you raised of how thinking more broadly can actually help everybody, not just the one or two people you're thinking about, but just think about all of behavior and really doing good for everybody.
Right.
The reason you need the laws, by the way, is that putting in closed captions was expensive, but by requiring it, mm-hmm. The problem is if you don't require it, then a company that does it spends a lot of money and therefore has to charge more or earn less money or maybe be less profitable and maybe to go out of business. And the way to even the ground so everybody has to pay the same amount of money is to require it. And that causes everybody to do it. That's how automobile safety happened. We started to require that automobiles mm-hmm. be made safer. That seatbelts have to be required, and then pretty soon complex seatbelts and airbags. Because they were required, everybody had to put them in and they were not at a disadvantage in cost.
Right. Yeah, and I think what's really interesting is that you are, when in the chapter or the part of the book around meaning, you talk that it's a lot about communication, how do we measure success, right? Could you elaborate on that? How do we have to change the way we measure success, and what are some of the problems that are holding us back to measure maybe success in that way?
One of the problems we face is that a lot of what we do is ruled by the economists, and the economists love to measure things because if you can't measure it, they say you don't understand it. But they measure everything in the same unit. And the same unit is always dollars or euros. But the point is money. So they transform everything into monetary values. And that's very artificial. It's not what we really care about, first of all. So, you know, how do you value the cost of life? What? You can't value life with a number, but they do it anyway. And the problem is the things we care about are not easy to measure. Oftentimes, we don't know at all how to measure. So what we do is we measure something that's related to what we care about. And we name it by the thing we care about. And then we forget that what we're measuring is not what we care about, but it's something different. And so that's one of the dangers. So how do we measure success? Well, again, the economists love to measure success in terms of income, say. How much money do you have to run your life? But actually, when psychologists study the impact of your income on your happiness and enjoyment and feeling that you're succeeding in life, yes, you have to have enough money so that you don't have to worry about eating or paying the rent or paying the mortgage, getting clothes. But once you've reached that point, getting more money doesn't make you happier. In fact, in many ways, getting too much money makes you unhappy. Because what people really care about and what makes them happy is that they feel they have some control over what they're doing. And they also feel that they're doing something of some significance. So having control and having feeling that you are actually contributing to something is very important. Can that be measured? Well, yes, it can be. Psychologists are really good at measuring all sorts of qualitative things by various types of measures. And we ought to be looking more at that. There are some countries that actually try the happiness index, which they try to measure the happiness of their population. Whether they're successful or not is not what's important, because they're doing their very best to try to take a meaningful thing and use that as a measure of how successful their policies are. And we'll get better and better at measuring these very difficult to measure attributes. Because again, you know, let loose the psychologists who are, they're the best ones at measuring these sorts of things because they look at real behavior. And the worst thing to do is use questionnaires, use forms. No, that tells you what people think, or what people think that you want. Then people think about what
people say.
They expect to be, yeah, they should say. And I keep asking people who use questionnaires, well, you must have to fill out a lot also for other people doing surveys, right? Do you trust the answers that you put down? No. They weren't the right, they didn't give me the right possibilities. They didn't ask the right questions. Well, then if you don't trust the answers you give the questionnaires, why do you trust the answer people give you in your questionnaires? Questionnaires are a bad way of assessing things. And we do need to do more work in measuring the things that matter. But actually, if you go look at the social sciences, you'll discover that almost anything you want to measure, someone has figured out a way of getting at pretty close what we care about. But no, the economists don't use it because it's not in terms of money.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I think we touched earlier on in terms of like how psychologists are in a good position to kind of measure that type of success. And I think it becomes more transparent also in the area of sustainability.
Be careful, because psychologists have the standard problem of academics. They do these wonderful studies and who do they study? Well, they study students in their university or college or school. Right. Because it's very easy to find them, but the students are not normal. I mean, that's why they're in college, and they're not typical of the wide variety of people in the world. So you have to be careful there. And second, even when they find some decent results, who do they tell? They give talks at psychology conferences. They publish in psychology journals. Well, who reads? Who goes to those conferences? Who reads them? It's other psychologists. So they're all talking to themselves.
Right.
I say, if you really want somebody to pay attention to what you're doing, publish in the magazines and the places that they read.
The business
publish in
world.
The Wall Street Journal or the Harvard Business Review. The best of the European newspapers that everybody reads.
Yeah.
Because they aren't going to come to your conferences. Yeah. On top of that, you use a jargon that only the specialists understand. You have to talk in everyday language.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you're touching on with the measurement aspect is interesting. I mean, talking about sustainability, I think there are more and more ways to, or also laws in place, like how to measure sustainability. For example, measure how sustainable a company is, the legislations into place, frameworks. You're touching in your book on circular economy also, as you know, and the complications about implementing a circular economy, which is oftentimes, you know, very much a challenge. How do you move from the collaborative phase where we're trying to make sense out of things and the idea towards an actual implementation? Also, from my experience, this has been one of the key challenges. And I was wondering if you, if there would be an example for you of where this, a market example that you know, where this has been very successfully implemented, or some kind of story that, you know, kind of highlights that it's possible to overcome these challenges when it comes to so-called economy and the implementation of that.
Yeah, I think there's a number of good examples. Patagonia is a sporting goods company. They make clothing,
right? Yeah,
which is now what's called a B Corp. So instead of a normal corporation where you owe your allegiance to the shareholders, a B Corp, it's no, we owe our allegiance to our customers, to the location where we are housed, and to the world, to the environment. And that's good. And second of all, they make a big point about trying to use recycled material, and they try to make things that themselves can be recycled, which is very important because one of the world's worst polluters is the fashion industry. And by fashion, I don't mean just the fancy fashion shows, but all clothing and textiles. And so that's good. And Canon makes laser printers, and I use a Canon laser printer, and it has these cartridges, big cartridges you have to replace periodically. That I have four different cartridges for three colors and black and white. And when I want to replace them, if I buy a new Canon cartridge, it comes in a box. And Canon says, take out the old cartridge, put in the new one, take the old cartridge and put it in the same box. And here's a QR, here's a code that will tell you how to print out a mailing label. So you can mail it back to us without cost to you. We pay the postage. And we have designed the cartridge so that every part of it can be reused. There would be no waste, zero waste. We use it either for the next, for someone else's cartridge, or in some cases, we can melt down the metal and use it for new construction. And the automobile industry, especially in Germany, there is more and more emphasis on trying to make sure that your car can be, if you like, recycled, repurposed. I just bought a new BMW, and BMW is very proud of the fact that they are working very, very hard to minimize the impact upon the environment. So first of all, I have an electric vehicle for BMW. It's the BMW i4, for those of you who care. It's a really neat car. And but it's they've done a really good job of trying to use materials that are reusable. And it's not completely there, but they're moving in that direction. And so there are a fairly large number of examples that one can give. More and more companies are moving in this direction, and that's good.
Yeah, and I think we touched on something important that you mentioned, for example, like the Canon example, and but it also with Patagonia. Yes, there is that. There's two components to it. On the one side is the sort of innovation on the process and the overall way a product is either manufactured or serviced and the system of the product. Yeah, but it's only successful if you also design the behavior around it, right? Specifically with sustainability, I mean, you can design the system in a way where it's sort of circular, but it only works if you also designing for the behavior that actually people feel motivated to play in that circle, right? And I think there are also good examples where there was a good intention but a bad outcome, which I think is kind of interesting to think about. Again, sort of like output and outcome, sort of say. It has these two components. The behavior that you also mentioned earlier is an important aspect here as well. And I think kind of like bringing us maybe to the other aspect that you're touching on in your book, which is humanity-centered design instead of human-centered design, right? It looks at sort of the bigger picture. Some other people also say like planet-centered design, for example, right? Of course, the planet and humanity are very much connected, right? Without the planet, we don't have any humanity, right?
People are trying to. I say, look, if you want to have if you want to use a three-word phrase to describe what you're doing, and one of the words is design, so you only have two words. What can you say so that no matter what choice you're going to make, it's not going to be satisfactory for everybody?
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, the people who do planet-centered design and what I argue for is humanity-centered design, which is a term that's been around about 20 years. And people who have other sorts of names, we're all doing after the same thing.
Exactly.
It is the name that matters. It's what's inside there. And so you're right. I talk about humanity because to me, that means worrying about the ecology as well, because the physical environment affects the life of animals and plants, and the lives of animals and plants affects us.
100%, yeah. So how do we moving into that phase of humanity-centered design?
It's actually those people who do human-centered design will I think sympathize, because it's basically the same thing. Human-centered design, I argue, is four different principles, and I say humanity-centered design has five, but the four are simply expansions. Some of them are identical, and some are simple expansions to take a larger systems point of view. And the last one is when we talk about work designing for society, we don't want to be like the old nations who went into and colonized and said, oh, we see that you don't know how to govern yourself, so we'll govern you for you, and isn't that nice? You should be happy that we're setting up schools for you, and we're setting up ways of running your country for you. No, that doesn't work. And so when we go in, when design students love to go to some foreign country, spend a couple of weeks there, find a problem, come back, do a solution, get a winner prize. But if you actually try to implement that solution in that country, it doesn't work usually because they don't understand the culture. They don't understand what people are good at. They don't understand how people think in that culture. It may be a very intelligent solution, but not for them. And when we get the United Nations and Foundation sends in people to try to help help the other countries, and we send in all the experts, and we spend a lot of money, and they come up with a big plan, and the experts are really good experts, and they tell you what's wrong, and they tell you what the solution is, but they don't understand the people. And so quite often, almost always, they spend a lot of money and they fail. And it takes longer than they expected, and they spend more than they expected, but it still fails because they didn't understand people. Right. And so what I say is, this is not original with me. I say, let's not design for people. Let's let the people design for themselves. Let's go in and find the intelligent people who already understand the problems they're facing. And a lot of them are, very intelligent. They've started to develop solutions to the problems. So why don't we become facilitators and mentors, help provide them with the resources they need to do what they're trying to do. And quite often they focus on the symptoms. They understand the symptoms are just symptoms and they have to really study the underlying issues, but those are more complex than they can do. We can help do that for them. With them.
Yeah, we just did it for
people and by people. That's the humanity-centered.
And I think we're just making a full circle because we're bad at symptoms and like how we initially started out with the discussion on healthcare. And I think it's very true what you said is that the importance of local innovation and working together people. If you see a lot of innovation happening in rural area, sometimes it's just coming from the outside, forced in, without having the local people actually, why not equipping them with the opportunity to innovate and design themselves, because they know best what is good for them.
They may not know best. They may actually something that's not the best, but it's better than what they have. But it's acceptable to them because it's theirs, yeah. They own it. And once they make that small step, well, it can keep improving because they themselves will start to recognize the deficit.
And this this connects really well, I think, back to what you said about designing in a business setting, like how do you bring humanity-centered into their own sustainability? It's the same aspect where you're trying to become like a facilitator of different parties and you're trying to connect them rather than to come up with all the answers yourself. But consult these experts, bringing them into the process, because that's going to increase your chance of implementation for whatever you're going to come up with in that process.
And don't try to change the whole system all at once.
Yeah.
The best way is incremental, small steps. Because with small steps, people can understand, people can actually manage. And on top of that, since if you try to change a big system, it's very big, takes a long time, and therefore becomes inflexible. You've started off on this path, and now with the passage of time, the world has changed, but you're stuck on your path. If you do it in small, simple steps, you're flexible. And as the world changes, you can modify what you're doing, take advantage of that. So, those are all the principles of the book.
Right.
Some of them all, actually.
Yeah. And I think the last point was really good that, it's also about not taking too big steps, which is a problem of behavior design as well. If you're trying to make the steps too large, like it's not happening.
For the computer programmers, I talk about the agile system of software development,
right?
Which is basically doing small steps.
Yeah.
Because with agile, instead of trying to do the foundation first and do all the stuff that's going to be necessary to support the whole thing, you take one little slice. And you do what's called a minimum viable product. You do something that works from the beginning to the end. And maybe you're developing a complex accounting system. And what you do is you do something that simply adds up two numbers. But you show that it can be done. And then you make it a little bit more powerful. And then a little bit more powerful. And pretty soon it can do simple accounts. But nothing as complex as you want to do. But by doing it in these small, simple steps, you first of all get a lot of feedback. Second of all, you keep people apprised. They say, I can begin to see how that's going to work. And this kind of flexibility through small incremental steps is very powerful.
100% totally I agree. And I think it's oftentimes, like, you know, overlooked also when it comes to the implementation of innovation in terms of like how to massage that in. Don, I really want to thank you so much for time. I think we could continue for a longer time here. There's enough substance, I feel. but I also want to respect your time. And I know we're reaching like the top of the value time.
There's here, enough substance to write a whole book about it. There's enough substance to write many books. I left out lots of things. Those require separate books and different skills too. I focus on the things I'm good at, but there's a bunch of other books coming out that I think are really excellent because they focus on, they're consistent with what I'm trying to talk about, or I'm consistent with them, but they talk about different aspects and different parts of the story. So yeah, it's we could talk for a long time, and I very much enjoyed this conversation, but yeah, that's why I wrote the book.
Yeah,
so there's an opportunity to, first of all, to talk about my book, but second of all, to hear your thoughts.
A lot of things that you have been, I think, saying, I think, and I also like, I think what you said is that, you know, you're trying to bring all of this knowledge that you have gathered throughout your career into one book. And I think it's so fascinating. I think like how we're slicing that. And I think really focusing on, I think, like you said, like, how can we make designers more influential in shaping a better world, and sort of dissecting it into like meeting sustainability and humanity. And I think it's fascinating. So really appreciate your time, Don. I think it's a incredibly important contribution, I think, not just the design community, but I think beyond that. So
thank you.
All right. That was the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to give it a thumbs up and let me know in the comments about your thoughts and biggest learnings from the episode. I'm always super curious about that. You can also tag me in a post about your biggest takeaway and share your insight with others to pass on your learnings. If the episode provided you a lot of value, make sure to follow, subscribe, and share it with friends and colleagues so they also have the chance to learn and grow. Until next time, cheers.